Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini. Thanks for coming back to the podcast. You've caught me doing some light reading. Andy Timmons, how did you get so goddamn good? We are excited for our latest episode of the Go See Talk podcast experience. Before we get into the fun stuff, I'd like to cue up my co-host with the most, Matt Jacobs. Matt Jacobs, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me again. Andy, great to have you here.
Thrilled to be here. I'm very curious about that light reading. It must be very, very light reading. It is fiction, right? That is a fictitious.
It's called Shiver, book. AKA Andy Timmons. How did you get so goddamn? Your music gives me chills. But
come on, man.
We are extraordinarily happy to introduce our next guest. You've already seen his face. You know his music, but he is the silky smooth music man, jazz dabbler, legendary shredder of a band so naughty they named it twice. He's the Bob Ross of six strings, a true guitarist. And a hell of a nice guy. So when words fail, he doesn't. He is pure, tonally perfect playing abilities. So please help us welcome the electric gypsy himself, Andy.
What Andy, an introduction. Now I just got to soak in that introduction for a second. That was quite lovely. You need to be my new press agent and write my bio or something, because that's way better than anything I've ever had. So thank you for that. Things are good. Things are good. You know, it's not 100 degrees, so it's not so bad out there. I walk 4 miles every day. First thing is now my new little health regimen. And even when it was 100 degrees, I was out there doing it. And definitely life changing for the better. But all that to say is all things are on track, doing good, working on lots of music, and happy to be here chatting with you guys. But that introduction is a lot to live up to. I hadn't heard the Bob Ross comparison before, but I guess I could get a perm and try to, go down that path a little bit.
Well, there's a specific reason I brought that up. We'll get to later in the interview. But
mine is intertwining, yeah.
Exactly. So we plan this out methodically, a lot like you. I think that every step that you take to compose your magnificent compositions are so tailored and dense and absolutely laser focused. But Andy, you've been in Texas 27 years. We consider you a Texas boy. Can we go with a grapefruit of a question and just talk about your Deep Ellum days? What's changed? Yeah. What's the same? Who are your friends? Let's go to town on that one.
Oh, man. So Deep Ellum for me, there was a pretty specific time that I was quite active down there. But so going back to how I ended up in Texas, I got here in 85, actually. I was just, I had been in Miami for a couple of years, my third and fourth years of college at the University of Miami, met some guys there, Steve Bailey, great bass player, Ray Brinker. They had gone to North Texas in Denton and wanted to move back there to record and form a band, which we did, called Brinker, which actually those tapes, that was recorded in 86. Those tapes just got released officially on an Australian label this year, which is, we don't like to rush into anything. We just waited, 40 years. But so then when that had its run, I joined a local band called the Molly Maguires, but I formed the Andy Timmons Band. That first demo of my early trio is the tape that got in the hands of Danger Danger, ended up in New York, but then moved back here. So officially maybe 94, I became a permanent resident, because I've been here since then. And at that time, I mean, Deep Ellum has definitely gone through multiple, incarnations, for sure. And I'm definitely not a historian about that. Now, Mike Dane, the bass player that still works with me in the Andy Timmons Band, he would know the history a lot better than I, because there was so many different scenes. There was kind of a punk scene. And of course, the New Bohemians and a lot of the bands that were forming there in the mid to late 80s. But so when I came back to town, after Danger Danger, not a lot of money, just needed to play a bunch of gigs. So I was just taking whatever local gigs I could and formed kind of a pseudo blues band with a guy named Mike Medina, a great bass player and friend of mine, and recruited Tommy Young on B3. And Mitch Marine was the original drummer. And we started playing every Wednesday night in Deep Ellum at a place called the Blue Cat Blues, which was on Commerce, I believe. Yeah, it was on Commerce. And anyway, played there literally every Wednesday night that we were all in town and available, so we had this platform to, you know, get out and do this. We called it a blues band, but it was, you know, Tommy was a big Booker T and the MG and Jimmy Smith disciple. So we had all that really greasy, good 50s, 60s blues, you know, and jazz. So we could, we did everything from, you know, blues, but we do some of my, my instrumental material, or we do, you know, The Loner by Gary Moore, whatever we decided, you know, we felt like doing. But the Andy Timmons band would play. We used to play Club Dada early on. Yeah, that goes back to the late 80s. Some of our first gigs were at the Club Dada. Then, of course, Trees, but yeah, the Curtain Club also. But I do remember, you know, one gig as we're loading out of the Curtain Club. This had to be mid to later 90s. You know, things got dangerous down there for a while. There's a lot of gang activity. So it seems like it goes in different waves of being cool, but then gets kind of like dodgy for a while. But then I just remember coming out of a gig and it was like a line of SWAT team sweeping the streets. And I'm like, you know, cover me. I'm going to my car, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, it's had its ups and downs, but if you go back to the early history, that's where a lot of the great bluesmen would play. Blind Lemon Jefferson. And of course, Robert Johnson recorded not far from there. About half of his recorded output was in a little building, you know, just not too far out of Deep Ellum. But yeah, the Blue Cat was fond days, just because we had a home and people would come every week, even though we probably played a lot of the same tunes every every week. We had a great time. It was always fresh, a lot of improvising, great camaraderie with the band. That was a really special time for me. So now it's a little rare that I get down there. I guess we've played the Bomb Factory a couple times. But yeah, I tend to play in Texas. I tend to play there's the great Guitar Sanctuary not far from where I live here in McKinney. And they've got a cool venue attached to this amazing guitar shop. So that's, you know, it's 10 minutes from my house. So out of laziness, that's where I play.
Creature of convenience. That's great.
No doubt. Every now and then the Kessler is a great place too, that we like to play. That's a really good listening room. Dig that.
Kind of makes me think, like, when you play the same things again, it's like you were YouTube before YouTube. Somebody can come and always hear you playing the same stuff. Like, hey, 60 million visits, not views. And,
Yeah, exactly. Well, they would have heard Little Wing every night and probably cry for you, you know. And people would request it every night. They just loved what we would do with those tunes every night and just have fun with it. So, yeah. And it's just always great to have that outlet, whatever I was doing in my, because through those years, I would have still had the Andy Timmons band. I was, you know, began working with Olivia Newton-John in 99. That lasted 15 years. Then I was also working with Simon Phillips. So, but when you're home, you know, so it's just good to have that gig to go play just to keep those chops together, whether I'm working in the studio or whatever. It's different when you're with your band playing live and soaking up the energy of the people. So that was, that's always good to have that. It's awfully handy. Like Mike Stern would play for years at the 55 bar up in New York every Monday night that he was around, you know. It's just good to have that outlet. So I missed that a little bit.
But you mentioned Cry For You. I mean, that's like the Ballad of Paul Revere, Beethoven's Fifth, Foggy Mountain. Holy crap, that's an immortal song. I'd love to get into that too. But the question, sure, I want to ask for you, you're surrounded by Marshall, which is great.
Marshall, yes. Yeah.
Did I see that you got a signature O'Million audio pedal system? Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Well, I wish I had a better system to move around, but if you can see, there's my pedal boards over here. There's my 68 Plexi. You can see that I'm using that right now on some session stuff. And yeah, Brian O'Million, who for years was based out of the Guitar Sanctuary, is now working independently, but he's still close by. So he does all my builds and all my tweaks. And he's nothing if not meticulous. He's incredibly amazing at how he lays everything out and gets everything sounding great. But of course, the brain of the board is the Daniel Steinhardt's gig rig, the G3 switching system. So that's kind of the brain and the heart and soul of the rig. And then all my assorted necessary gadgets that I love, you know.
So how much input do you have to get the AS tone? Is it like, do they just give you something and it's like, tweak this? Or are you in the trenches with the...
What do you mean AS? What does that mean?
AT, Andy Timmons.
Oh, well, I mean,
at first I was thinking that Andy Timmons Experience, your acronym could be 8.
It could be eight. I like that. I ate. What did I eat? No, it's well, especially since working with Keeley, it's been extremely in the trenches. So, my earlier signature pedals, there was one with Exotic called the BB preamp. And that essentially was just trying to get them to replicate my magic very early BB preamp, which was down to the switch that was used. It was down to the clipping and the compression had changed over time. But it was really literally down to it sounded better with a crappier switch. Like they improved the switch. It's like ruin the tone. It's like, but that's what, you know, so, but with the actual circuit, it was just a circuit that I dug. And the same thing was with when I started using the JHS Angry Charlie. And I met Josh, who's an amazing guy. And he said, man, since you started using this pedal, we're selling a lot more pedals, you know, maybe if you want to do a custom version. And that's when we got in, just tweaked very basic things. It didn't reinvent the pedal, but I shaped it to what I really wanted it to do. But then when it came time to work on my signature delay, my dual echo, Daniel Steinhardt, you know, when I asked him who would be, you know, the best company to work with, you know, to come up with this ultimate echo that I wanted to design. And he just, without flinching, said, you know, Robert Keeley. And so that began basically a nearly a 2.5 year process. Once we started working on that echo, it took about a year and a half, but half the work was done in this room and half the work was done in Oklahoma City. We're 3 hours apart. You know, Keeley's in Oklahoma City, McKinney, 3 hours. So instead of, you know, here, we'll FedEx you the pedal, but what do you think? Well, it needs more air around five, you know, you can't describe sound really. I mean, you can, but it's not, it goes way beyond science and graphs. Cause I've had people tell me, you know, it says right here, it's identical. the graph says, I'm like, well, I'm telling you, it's not, you know? So we were able to be in the room throughout the whole process in a year and a half of back and forth. And once they realized, oh, okay, Andy has these ears and these ideas, and they were, and I saw that they've also got the ears and ideas, and we were both willing not to accept anything less than better, if and not way better than what I was already using, which was a combination of vintage and modern things that all did iterations of what I love about the great echo sounds, the old tape echo EP3 Maestro that I love, the Memory Man, Electro Harmonics original echo, and the Strymon did a good job of kind of me trying to replicate those things. So this kind of was the next level of what I loved about all those units. And they were just willing to go down the path, which it's like being in the studio. If you've got somebody, I've been blessed with, you know, Robert Wexler early on, my incredible engineer, co-producer, and Mike Dane, the bassist in my band is an incredible engineer and co-producer. So each guy is like willing to go, you know, to whatever lengths that it takes to get to where we feel like we've got something great, but that's not always the case. Sometimes there's, you know, there's budgetary issues. There's, you know, well, it gets down to money a lot, doesn't it? You might've noticed that thread in the world is like, you know, so none of these things I would have ever done if it was about money. That's the thing. It's like, these aren't billable hours. You know, the time it takes to do what you want to do as far as the level that you want to achieve. It's not about, I expect to get paid XYZ for my time, but if you love something enough, it doesn't matter, you know, and somehow along the way, whatever career that I've had or managed to still have, I think it's based on that, you know, and maybe at this point in my life, that brand is becoming more recognizable about, well, I just don't want to put stuff out there for the sake of putting it out there. I want it to meet my expectations, which of course it never quite does, but by having that personal bar set, you know, is a great thing, even though it can be torturous for yourself and those around you. But getting to the point about Robert Keeley and his team, you know, and Robert Wexler and Michael Dane and Mike Medina, I'm blessed with great people around me that are as invested as I am in just doing something that's worthwhile and not just cranking out a product. You know, at the end of the day, yeah, I'm happy that the Halo and then after that the what's now the Mark III driver with Keeley, they've done incredibly well, but it started off very selfish. It's just, this is the gear that I really, really want. And then of course, if there's people that are interested in my sounds, this is one way to get there quicker, because there's no secrets. It's like it comes these are my sounds. And so I feel in a way that in those pieces are as much of a legacy as the music and the playing. That's kind of an odd thing to think about, but it's true. And I see that is something I'm really proud of, you know?
Couldn't say it better myself.
Any one piece of gear that you're particularly fond of in terms of how it came about, in terms of the development process and sort of where that piece of gear ended up?
Yeah, well, that for sure is the Halo. I mean, no doubt about that. I've been an Echo fan even before I knew what Echo was. You know, George Harrison's guitar solo on I Saw Her Standing There, which really is an Echo, but it's extremely reverberant. You know, they put his guitar sound into that infamous Studio 3 reverb room. And I just always loved that ambient sound. And then when I heard, you know, guys in the 70s using the tape echoes, and that was just a thing. I love the space around the notes. And so again, for Robert Keeley, Aaron Tackett, Aaron Pierce, everybody at Keeley, just really Robbie Harris on the graphics, just everything about that whole journey was so rewarding. Not only, but because I got the sound that I really got the sound that I was imagining. It's really a better version than all my favorite old stuff. You know, I can go back to my old things and I hear what I love about it, but I also hear, well, it's not doing what we did. You know, it's not doing what this sound is, that again, just to have the imagination and the drive to want that very selfishly, but then to have that team be like, yeah, this is a blast. let's go for it. And it's still that way. I mean, we're still collaborating. Like I say, the Mark III driver is like the third iteration of Robert's original, you know, Keeley modded blues driver, which is an old Boss circuit that now we've taken to a whole nother level, capable of way more stuff. Love the old circuit. It's great. But so those two pieces specifically, of course, my guitars, you know, with Ibanez, you know, this was just a simple idea when I first started working with Ibanez back in 91, you know, they were like, you know, I was in Danger and I was, you know, doing, I guess, fairly well for whatever a musician thought they would be doing well with, which was being on MTV. But that's another story about what you think is the Holy Grail, which is completely not. But they were like, what's your ultimate guitar? Well, Bill, do anything you want. I'm like, oh my gosh, I one with six strings. I never had the wherewithal to try a bunch of stuff. I really had no idea. I endorsed Kramer before that, which was just out of an opportunity of having met Buddy Blaze, the artist relations guy. But they went down a path. They sent me, you know, all their best instruments for me to try. And it basically got down to, I had this old part Strat that Kramer had put together. It might've been Schecter or Chandler parts. I said, I just like this old unfinished neck. It just feels great. And they had the RG body, so I wasn't very Strat-like. So I wanted a Strat that looked like Eric Johnson's 54, you know, tobacco verse, the classic. And of course, he being one of my ultimate heroes, for sure, sonically and musically. That's where it started. And it's basically, but with the modern amenities, you know, there's this humbucking pickups and, you know, a more stout bridge and some basic things about it. And I love old Stratocasters. I've got a couple nice ones. They're very great for what they do, but there's limitations. I couldn't do a night of my own music entirely on a Strat, but people love it when I pick up the old guitar. But I'm also, you know, very blessed that, you know, we're still working on new designs with Ibanez. My newest guitar, the ATZ 300, I don't have right now. It's being refretted, but it's based on the old AT 300, which was the mahogany. I can't see myself on screen. I hope I'm still in focus here, but this is an old AT 300 from the mid 2000s. But this is instead of the old Alder body Strat style, it's mahogany with a rosewood board. And so the new ATZ 300, it is mahogany rosewood, but the pickups are mounted in a pickguard instead of into the body. So it's kind of best of both worlds between the 300 and the 100. So, I mean, just all of this is insane, because to be this little kid from Evansville, Indiana, with, you know, no idea how to do what I'm doing, meaning I couldn't have imagined having my own signature guitar or pedals. It's just unimaginable. There was, you know, very small town and kind of a narrow minded, you know, thing that maybe I grew up with, but I just kept going. I just figured out guitar is my life. And I had a mother that raised, you know, her four sons with with the idea of like, whatever it is you want to do, go for it 1,000%. And here I was, you know, growing up at 13 years old, I had Kiss pictures on all four walls. I got my first job, bought my first, you know, no name electric guitar, was listening to Kiss Alive. I'm learning how to play. And she could have been, oh my God, what is my kid into, you know? But never discouraged, only encouraged. And I started taking guitar lessons at 16. And she arranged, you know, for me to go to college. We had no money, but through student loans and, you know, whatever work study programs, I managed to study classical for 2 years. Then I went to Miami, like I mentioned, was a jazz major, you know, and that was four of the most valuable years and years of growth that I ever experienced, all just based on my desire and my drive, but my mother encouraging me and a couple key people in Evansville, you know, saying, yeah, you need to go do this. If you don't do this now, you'll regret it the rest of your life. Somebody said to me at a music store, a guy named Bruce Jeffries from, ironically, he had a store called the Dallas Pro Shop in Evansville, Indiana, not knowing I would end up in Dallas. So there's those little key decisions along the way that is really the only reason I'm sitting talking with you guys now. You know, I could have done fine if I stayed in my town and maybe have done okay, but it was just one of those things, you know, I needed to get out and somehow meet, you know, similarly driven people. And that's what the music school was for me. You know, when I got to Miami, there was some of the greatest players still to this day that I've ever gotten to hang with. And we were all just on fire together. There were some great fusion and jazzy guys and great readers. And I was kind of the rock guy. We just all hung together and learned together. So anytime now when I go to do these camps, you know, I just did one with Steve Morse at Andy Wood's Woodshed. And you go and there's all these, you know, amazing other players that are there to do concerts and teach. And I'm honored to be a part of that. But then all the people coming from all over just to hang and learn, and they're all playing. It's like being in school where you get that energy of everybody that's got the same passion and love of something that it's a special thing that not everybody has, you know. That's why going to concerts is so special, or if you're a churchgoer, anywhere you can go where there's people of like, you know, loves and passions, you know, that's a beautiful thing, you know. And of course, music in general is a very positive thing to be a part of. So that has been my church, you know, along with whatever beliefs. It's just, you know, it's been everything for me and still is.
So Andy, I feel like you're sort of reading our minds here, because one of our broader goals was to get a better understanding of what makes you tick and how you became the type of player that you are today. And So you could have played the piano, you could have played the sax, you could have played the bass guitar, but you decided to pick up the electric guitar. And so you mentioned a couple of influences that you've had from your younger years, but what was it about the electric guitar that made you want to become so proficient in that instrument?
It's so easy to answer that. I just loved everything about it. Again, even like I say, before I knew what a guitar solo was, the favorite part of that song, the flip side of I Want to Hold Your Hand, I saw her standing there, was there, and it was just that music. I just, and there was the sound of that guitar. And then, so I had three older brothers that, you know, bought all the records in the 60s. I was born in 63. My oldest brother was 12 years older. So all those records in real time were in the household. And then he was buying, you know, Dave Clark Five and Herman's albums and Beatle albums. And I would see these instruments. And so I started begging my mother from the age of four, you know, there would be these plastic guitars at the dime store with nylon strings, and they were actually playable, you know. And I would be learning, you know, melodies on one string, even at the age of four and five. My three older brothers played a little bit. There were acoustic guitars around the house. They showed me how to play I'm not Your Stepping Stone by the Monkees on one string. And I was off and running. So it was certainly physical. I loved the look of the guitar, the sound of the guitar. And ever since those early memories, I could just remember just wanting to do it. And once I finally got to the point where I could sneak into the rooms and try to learn the chords I saw them play, because it was kind of forbidden, you know, verboten, don't go in my room and don't touch my stuff, you know, which is what you need boundaries with little brothers, I suppose. But no, I just started teaching myself a little bit. And then, you know, my older brother, Mark, took me to his, he had a friend named Bill Doty that had a electric guitar and an amp. And he showed me the power chord and the A minor pentatonic. And, you know, there I was. Once I figured out the Kiss was tuned down a half step, I started learning all those tunes and just was I never looked back. And again, it's, I never had a specific path and not still really don't. It's just kind of this, I kept after it. I kept doing it. And that just seems to be a common thread with anybody that has any kind of career of longevity of any sort. It's the foundation is love for it. The foundation is driven to not accept where you are, you know, being dissatisfied in a health is healthy to a degree. It's absolutely necessary if you're going to keep growing. I always, you know, I'll refer to Jeff Beck for the rest of my life as far as somebody was like, he could have been on the guitar Mount Rushmore after Shapes of Things by the Yardbirds in 65. Just one of my favorite guitar recordings of all time. But he kept growing, he kept innovating. But by the time he got to the Jeff Beck group a few years later, it was the template for Zeppelin. He was there first doing that with Rod Stewart, Ron Wood. It's just incredible, incredible records. And then he discovers Jan Hammer and Mahavishnu and goes down the path of fusion. And then where he ended up by the time he did Where Were You on Guitar Shop, or even more importantly for me, the Emotion and Commotion record in 2015, was it? Something like that. Maybe earlier. He just kept going, you know, and even without the success of his like Clapton or Page, his kind of Yardbird contemporaries, I love his trajectory even more so. And I love Clapton and I love Jimmy Page, what they contributed in their days, you know, magnificent. But Jeff was the one that quite recognizably kept evolving. And that's kind of more of a beacon for me, you know. I'm 61 now, so I've been at it for a long time. But I know that I'm scratching the surface with whatever I feel my potential is. And that's what drives me. That's what keeps me going. I look backward to the players that I love and can continue to draw inspiration from. And of course, I hear new players that are, you know, incredible. But I tend to gravitate to, you know, some of the early originators for the authenticity and somebody that really gave us something unique. Not that I want to replicate, but that I just want to be inspired by that, you know, and hopefully find my own voice through that, just by just keep doing it, you know. There's my thread. You just got to keep doing it. It's like, well, Captain Obvious. Yeah.
For those burgeoning guitarists out there that are thinking about how much they need to practice to get to whatever their goal is as a player, can you talk a little bit about how much you were practicing when you were developing as a young guitarist and reaching the level that you've kind of you've gotten to as a young adult? And then what do you think about the notion that some people say it takes around 10,000 hours of practice to become a master at something, whether it's guitar or carpentry or some other type of skill?
Sure. I mean, it's all valid ideas. Read the Malcolm Gladwell book. That's where that kind of originated from. It's a book called Outliers. And it's a really well-written book about perspective, about success, you know, why certain people become successful at certain times. It's not just about the 10,000 hours. That's undeniable, you know, for the guitarist, fingers on the frets. You can't replace that. You're not going to get a shortcut on YouTube and learn these seven licks and then you play. So first off, I was never a good practicer. Still not the best practicer, but I do practice. But I always played. And it's kind of the same, but it's not. So what I enjoyed was making music. And part of that was you do have to learn certain things. But then a lot of it is the repetition and the solidifying of those things, which it all contains foundation, you know. No matter what you're working on, it still involves the technique of producing the sound. And all that is the technique that is the really the basic stuff we all need to work on. Just, the, you know, from the vibrato to the tuning to, you know, bending and all these really basic things that are so important to the guitar. The time, of course. Yes, no, now there are, you know, there's infamous practice regimens. Steve, I had the 10 or 12 hour a day practice routine, all these things, and results are quite noticeable with people that approach things that way, which is never my path. Again, for better or worse, I'm not saying, you know, not to do that. I just think that everybody kind of has to find their comfort level of what works for them. But by comfort, I don't mean you know, not to work hard, but because I did, I look back on it and I was just always playing. The instrument was in my hands a lot, even though I wasn't with the metronome, at least initially, I wasn't with the metronome playing scales, but I was playing solos with my hero with the record. So it, you know, the drummer's the metronome and I'm playing music. So I think for me, whatever my personality type is or was, I was more interested in making music, and some people may not be so interested in playing those scales and learning things on from that perspective. And when it comes to the scales and the theory, it's not necessary. What is necessary is the foundations that I mentioned and playing music. Now, when I was 16, I started taking lessons. I was a fairly good, I was playing professionally for 3 years already. I could play well, but then I started to learn how to read. And that teacher, Ron Pritchett in Evansville, also taught me about, he started loaning me jazz records. So the more that my listening taste broadened, the more interested I became in the guitar. So I want to know how to do that. Even if it wasn't distorted Ace Frehley, Steve Lukather, rock guitar, you know, it was still guitar and I love the sound of it. You know, I was lucky that I was a little less narrow after a while and really embraced, you know, Barney Kessel and Wes and all music with guitar, you know, and still to this day, I think that's what feeds my growth is being open to a lot of different stuff. I don't really listen to, well, I can't say that. I go through periods of not really listening to guitar feature type music, but I love all kinds of songwriting. You know, I went through a year where I listened to nothing but Chopin a few years ago. And of course that's influenced my writing heavily. Not that I've copied, I have learned some of his pieces, you know, transcribing for piano to the guitar the best I could, but it was the emotional moments I would get from that composer. But it's the same with Beatle music to this day. There's still moments that you take with you. So you're circling back to the practice and all that. So, I mean, there's no substitute for time, you know, and once I did get kind of more into a regular practice routine, I became a happier person as far as just making sure that before the walk, I'll play guitar first thing every day in my office. I'll get the coffee going and just enjoy that time on the instrument. And a lot of times it may just be improvising on a jazz standard. But when I do that regularly every day, it helps everything. The playing is more connected with whatever I do during the day. But I'm also a happier guy because this is my, you know, my life. And when I'm doing more to honor that and really appreciating this is what I get to do, it feels great to further solidify and to try to keep growing, you know. And then hopefully by the time it comes to making music, that shows up, you know.
Yeah. So Andy, having talked a little bit about your emergence as a guitarist, we wanted to kind of move forward a little bit and kind of go into your period as a solo artist. And we had a question thinking about sort of timing and achieving notoriety or fame. So the kind of the basis of the question is kind of thinking about back to the 80s, and you've got a lot of some of the best guitar soloists, or at least the most well-known instrumental guitarists came about in that era. So you've got guys like Satriani and Vine, Eric Johnson, and it was sort of a golden era for instrumentalists playing the guitar. And so it's interesting, like if you go out and ask guitarists, like who are some of the best players to ever pick up the instrument, you're in that mix with those players and many others, right? So, but it's interesting that you came out with your first solo album, and I think it was 94 with your ex. So
94, 95, somewhere in there, yeah.
So like it's kind of an interesting time to put out a guitar forward instrumental album because music had changed pretty dramatically at that point, right? And so the 80s hard rock scene had ended, and you didn't see a whole lot of guitar solos, and instrumentals were not as popular in mainstream music. So I guess the question is, how much of a role do you think that timing plays in receiving or achieving broad recognition as an instrumentalist? And do you feel like you had to work harder because you came out kind of past a certain window to achieve that notoriety that you have?
That's a really great question. You know, part of it for me was as I was getting my instrumental thing together. It was very much influenced by Satriani initially, because, you know, Surfer with the Alien came out, and it was just like, yes, there's, of course, he's playing his ass off, but there were great songs. These are really good tunes, you know, and that appealed to me just as I'm a pop guy at heart, you know. So I formed the Andy Timmons Band in 1988 and started recording material, you know, not just based on Satch, but of course, you know, Vi was already, you know, huge on the scene. And we knew Eric in Texas. And of course, he was exploding with Obvious Musicom. And of course, all the, you know, just the older Hendrix and Stevie Ray, all these great guitar players. So by the time I got my first It's Getting Better, Wanted Man, Innocence Lost cassette together, you know, I sent it to Relativity Records because that's Joe and Steve's label at the time. And the guy was like, yeah, we've already got Joe and Steve, you know. So it was, there was a lot of, I was up against a lot of well-established, you know, players, and rightfully so. I mean, I'm on their coattails in a way as far as getting into that arena, so to speak. And that's right about the time I got the offer for two different gigs. One was for Danger Danger and the other was for Tower of Power. So that was quite a crossroads, so to speak, you know, Tower of Power being a much more, you know, muso-respected, you know, funky rock group out of Oakland. And then, but the allure of, you know, MTV and the pop, you know, metal arena, you know, so to speak, because that was my foundation. You know, I could have gone with the funk fusion, you know. I would have been happy if Miles would have called, you know. There was no Mike Stern, but I wanted to be, you know, but yeah, okay. But I can be a team player in this rock band. I guess, you know, it goes back to my Kiss days and Rush and Foghat and REO, and let's go. And it was a blast, but that's how I learned what my goals really were. I think at that point in everybody, any musician's career, you would think that getting signed to a major label and being on a major label record, which was my real goal. I just want to be on a record, you know, be on the name and the credits, like Steve Lukather, my hero, you know, this was a goal. And that was kind of, initially that was checking that box in a major way. And we did some amazing tours, opening for Kiss on two different tours, you know. My first concert I saw was Kiss in 76. So you can imagine the moments of like, I can't believe I'm here doing this. But as it went on and I recognized the music business, especially the label industry and how low the musician and the art, you know, was on the totem pole of importance. And it was just another big business, and people just did not matter. Careers just did not matter. And I saw those decisions being made while we'd be in meetings at Epic Records. And my one of my favorite moments, or most, I don't want to say favorite, most memorable moment was, we were in the meeting with the president of Epic, and they were promising us the world. We're releasing this new record. It's going to be great. You guys get out there. And somebody came in to ask a question about another band. We weren't friends of ours, but we knew their name from the label, and says, so what about these guys? And they just said, the woman said, don't worry about them. And I knew in that moment that all those lives were just affected by this woman's wave of the hand. I was like, okay. And that was just one small little element of like, okay, this is not what I really want out of life. What I want is what I'm here talking about with you guys now, 32 years later, is that I just love the guitar. I love music. And I knew after that band, you know, fell by the wayside, that has nothing to do with what I want. And so I went back to Texas. I'd been recording the tracks for what became Ear Ecstasy through my whole tenure with Danger Danger. And it was actually Reb Beach that, you know, encouraged me. I'd given him a demo of all the tracks that were going to be on the record. I said, yeah, here's the demos. You know, I'm going to re-record everything. And he says, well, what are you talking about? This is done. This is your record. This is great. It's like, cause I kept thinking, well, I'll get a deal. I'll do these, you know, in a bigger studio or something. But because it was done, you know, it was well recorded, but some of them I really thought were demos. But because there was zero pressure, it's all improvised. It's just seat of my pants. I'll redo it later. And then you live with it and you go, oh shit, I can't beat that, you know. So then from then on, I didn't even send it to a label. I just put it out on my own label. And then labels came to me, hey, we can license this. So my career just kind of started to trickle, just for me regrouping and saying, I just want to do this on my own terms. You know, I don't want to I don't want a label to own my music. That was the other thing with Danger Danger. That third record we did called Cockroach never came out until like 15, 20 years later because Epic owned it and made it impossible financially for us to get the rights to it. I thought, why would you ever work so hard on something and it not belong to you? None of this made sense. But it was when Steve Vai came along with Favored Nations in the early 2000s, he was the first guy, and I didn't go to him. He came to me and said, look, I'm forming this label. Would you be interested? And he talked to me about the business sense. Like, yeah, it's a 50-50 split after expenses. I'm like, this is the first reasonable deal ever. Like, okay, yeah, this makes sense. And that, so that became my next three records with That Was Then, This Is Now, the Resolution record, and then the Sgt. Pepper record, which by that time it says, you don't need me as your label, just form your own label and I'll distribute it. So he always had my best interests at heart. I know I'm giving very long-winded answers here, but I'm squeezing in a lot of history into a very good question. But where did we start with that? We were starting with... I'm so far past the question, I can't even see the question anymore.
Yeah, I think it was just more along the lines of thinking about how hard you had to work, just given the environment of kind of the music atmosphere at that time in the mid-90s, so different.
Well, circling back, I mean, I'm constantly seeing comments or people saying, you know, man, you're so underrated, or, you know, boy, you deserve to be a lot more famous. I've even had a very, very, very prominent, well-known player tell me that, you know, you just need to be more famous, as far as why I'm not being invited to join certain tours. So I gotta say, I'm really good with that. You know, I mean, there's the ego, and there's the hope that your music is accepted on the widest possible level. Of course, that's not a bad thing. But I have no problem with wherever I am and how people think of, you know, whatever hierarchy is necessary for people to create in order for them to organize things. Everybody has to have a favorite. There's got to be a top five, a top 10. I can't be concerned with any of that, but I'm so completely grateful that there's anybody that puts me in the same sentence with any of these heroes of mine, you know? And so, I can't be too concerned about it, but as I go, it just kind of seems to be fine and keep getting better. And I'm a little bit of an outlier in that I didn't get in a van and play 300 shows a year like that. Because by the time my instrumental career was kind of taking off, I was a little, you know, older and had done a lot of the touring. And so that became less attractive to me. That being said, and when I get offered the right situations, I do enjoy doing it. So it's a catch-22. I could have handled things and done things very differently, but I'm very happy with where I am in my life, you know? So there's a huge sacrifice to that lifestyle that is not healthy. And I'm lucky to still be here through just stuff I've been through without, you know, major drugs or whatever, but there's survival techniques that everybody kind of gets into with prescription drugs and alcohol that, you know, can easily take somebody out. It nearly got me. So luckily I made it through that time. And on the other side of it, especially after COVID, where nobody was traveling, you start to realize I can be very productive at home and still, you know, hopefully make great music, but still get out and do some touring, which I've got some more coming up in next year. So easing back into it. But yeah, I think my career has been just a little different than most. You know, I could be more famous, probably. Could I be more successful? No doubt. No doubt. But zero issues with where I am currently and where I feel that things kind of keep growing. So I'm very grateful.
Well, it's important that you're happy. I think that is the most satisfying response, whether it's you know, fame, fortune, fun, and frivolity. I think that, because Matt and I were reading some articles and interviews you've done with a guitar player, and one of them talked about how you specifically would get done with a tour and be whirlwind, and you come home, and just to find it all the dust settles, like, what do I do now? So I think the important thing is, like you said, the satisfaction of you finding, you know, your rhythm, your happiness. But as we're here to prop you up, we're fans. You see the adoration of the fans on YouTube. I think one of the best things that we had learned recently is when we all met at the Winger show, Reb Beats said you're his favorite guitarist, which is really high praise. And
he's amazing. Yeah.
I followed up with Kip and I said, you know, give me some dirt. Give me a joke. I want to, you know, mess with Andy on. And he goes, no joke other than the running joke that we're going to replace Reb with Andy. So,
well, they've been asking me to join Winger since 1993 or 92. I was still in Danger when Paul Taylor first left the group, I guess. And they asked me to join. I was still in Danger. So I was loyal to the band that I was in. But then of course, you know, when Kip started doing his solo records, I played on, I guess, all of them at this point, or at least most of his solo records. And, here's the deal. So they had a gig or something in South America, or maybe some shows. And, you know, Reb obviously works with Whitesnake, and there was some conflicts in the scheduling. And Kip called me, hey man, can you sub for Reb? And I said, absolutely no way. am I going to be the guy that's going to disappoint Winger fans? Because I could never play like Reb Beach. Oh my God. It would be the most epically falling short of what those songs need. It would be fun, but it would be, I'm not the right guy. I'm the right guy when Kip needs me for other music. But to try to, you know, do what Reb Beach does. Good luck, anybody. He's such a unique voice on the instrument. And I could never get close to that. I'm a huge fan of Reb's, absolutely. And he's just a great guy. We've been really, really good friends since those days, the early 90s. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
he's one of my favorites. Yeah, knowing your lane is important, but I will just finish this up with one thing Kip actually said, and I don't have a problem showing this. He says, ask Andy about him playing on my first solo record. It was a magical experience for both of us. He's got a direct plug into the universe like no one I know. So that speaks more to your not emulating, like you're saying, you're going to, you know, Chopin, you're hearing soloists and trying to figure out how you interpret them. And that's what makes the Andy Timmons experience, the Andy Timmons experience.
Well, thank you. And of course what Kip's talking about, I know exactly what he's talking about, but that was the environment that I was in. That was his music. That was his home outside of Santa Fe. It was his beautiful wife, Beatrice, was there at our sides the whole time. Their dog Ringo. And the beauty of that record was that I would fly in from Dallas. They could pick me up in Albuquerque, drive up to Santa Fe outside of where they lived outside of the town. And a lot of times I wouldn't have the music in advance. Like he would just roll the tape. I would hear the song for the first time and I would react. Maybe we do a few takes like that. We do some sessions like that. The next time I come back, maybe a couple weeks later, a few weeks, we work on the weekends a lot. He would have taken like what he liked about my playing. And sometimes he would have orchestrated vocals and strings to go with it. It was just, but there was so much, he's right. There was so much that was just intuition and spirit. But that takes a brilliant writer and producer to let that happen, because he could have easily gone, okay, man, here's what I'm hearing, you know, play like this. And there was some stuff like that. We totally clapped. There's a slide solo, very George Harrison slide solo on a song called How Far Will We Go? I think that's the song. One of the songs on this conversation, it seems like a dream. And we composed it together. You know, we totally heard, oh, George Harrison, here's what, you know, what would we do? And so there were some things that were very much like that. And some things that were just completely improvised. Like I said, I wish I knew some of the song titles and could remember the moments better. But that record may be my favorite record I've been a part of outside of my own music. It definitely is. I'm calling it that. It's my favorite record I've ever done outside of, because it's really me, you know, reacting to his world and being inside his world. And that's what he would say to me, man, you're inside this music. He felt that. And it was an organic thing. So again, one of my favorite people, one of my favorite writers, and I'm just so proud of him getting through all the bullshit that was thrown at him so unfairly and unnecessarily. But to rise above all that and to keep evolving as a human being and as a writer is ultimately inspiring. So yeah, that's an emotional time for me. I really, really treasure that.
Well, as we round down this interview, let's do a speed round. What do you say?
Okay. Give me a sip of my Americano here. All right, I'm in.
Yes, dear.
Going back to the idea of you're the Bob Ross of six strings. You were saying in an interview.
What does that mean? It was like because I paint in pastels. I'm not sure what the reference is.
So beautiful. You make it look easy. And people jealous. And people are just in awe. That's what it is.
But
you know, he famously says happy accidents. And I saw in an interview that you said it's okay to make an accident because you got to work through something. What's one of your favorite, like, hey, this wasn't intended, but this came out to be, you know, fireworks and magic?
Well, that's the whole resolution record, being inspired by a comment from Steve Vai about a song called Falling Down that was on the first record he released called That Was Then, This Is Now. And he gave me a compliment. I like that one song because it's just one guitar, no overdubs. I can hear the fingers on the frets. It's not really a happy accident, but it's having the antenna to recognize, well, that's something that he likes. Maybe, and that's what encouraged me to do that whole next record with no overdubs, because I was kind of bored with the instrumental guitar thing at that point. It's like early 2000s, 2003, 2004. It'd been done on such a high level by Steve and Joe and all these people that come before me, but it was recognizing that, what if I did that? And that's a moment where I had to reinvent how I was playing my music, because without overdubs, I've got to represent the harmony and the chords in a whole different fashion, and the tone better be great. And that's the first record that I start collaborating with Mike Dane as my co-producer and engineer. And again, talk about kindred spirits and people that are willing to spend the time to go down the path to look for greatness, just to really try to achieve, maybe always falling short. But if you're going for the highest bar, you're going to get closer than maybe you would have had you been like, that's fine, I'll let the engineer sort it out. One of those moments of just recognizing, this could make it interesting. I'm gonna have to work really hard. And I did. It took a lot of work to get to where I got on that record. But then I couldn't have done the Sgt. Pepper record without that experience. So just this recognizing this one little thing that somebody said to me changed my whole path. It just happened to be Steve Vai, but it can come from anybody. It can come from anything in your life that makes you go, what about that? So to kind of just be aware of that, making sure your antenna's up. And sometimes you don't know. I couldn't have known at that time by me having that thought, this is going to change my life. Or at least my playing path, but it did. You know.
Matt, you go. Speed round.
This is the slowest speed round ever.
Okay. And how about this? So when you're on the road or touring, playing shows, what's one thing that Andy Timmons can't live without and one thing you avoid at all costs?
Well, floss. I don't want to go on stage if I don't have floss. I guess flossing's becoming more important in later adult life. But that is true. I'm not really kidding. I just got to have a shower. I don't want to day to day. I just got to have a good shower. And then what was the second part of the question?
One thing that you avoid at all costs on tour.
Oh my gosh. I can't really think of anything off the top of my head. Obviously, just uncomfortable situations with anybody. I just want to avoid, just keep things peaceful. I'm a peace seeker, but I can't think of any specific. I think it's okay. Pizza after the gig. I'll just call it that. Just don't order a bunch of freaking pizzas for before or after the show, because it's just the worst. It tastes great in the moment, but. Yeah, so I've got the next lengthy tour I do is like just a few weeks in Italy, and it's my favorite country to visit because of food. But I've already thought about the email. Okay, dear Ricardo, maybe pizza on a day off, but nothing at the show. I just want salads and some good protein. Yeah, because that's the thing, man. Just food affects you so much, and when you're traveling, and it's so easy to make bad decisions when you're faced with some of these. Generic, food you get at some of the venues. So, but there's so much great food available in Italy. I'm going to make better choices and not eat crap after the gig. So that's what I'm going to avoid. We got there.
All right. Rank these soloists in your order of preference or favorite: Joe Pass, Bill Evans, and Oscar Peterson.
Assuming Bill Evans, the pianist. Okay. So, for emotional context, emotional content, no contest, it's Bill Evans. For pure bluesy greasiness, it's Oscar Peterson all day long. Nobody swings that hard, and nobody is as greasy and bluesy as that. And the and third, I hate rankings and choosing these things, but because Joe Pass should be, but it is Bill Evans, Oscar, and Joe. I love Joe, but emotional content, you know, get a lot out of Bill Evans. His version of My Foolish Heart, forget it. Just first time I heard there was a particular version I heard on a jazz station out of Denton. This was like 10 years ago. I had to pull over. It was like, it was that moving. The piano hadn't done it to me in the jazz world like that. Chopin does it to me, but Bill has that thing, and that's hard to get out of a piano, you know, I think. But there he was, nailing it. So, and I just love Oscar Peterson so much.
Well, yeah. I bring up Joe Pass because he sounds like 10 people playing, and which, you know, your compositions are so dense. You've got your drums and your rhythm, and you play lead, so it all comes together great. And it sounds like you are 10 people. So I think I put you guys in the same category. And so on that note, we'd like to round this out with, what are Andy Timmons' 10 favorite things?
10 favorite things.
Could be anything.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I've just got to say, my family, I love my wife, Monica, and my son, Alex, dearly. And then second would just be all the other loved ones that I have in my life, that my friends, you know, the people around me that have always believed in me, never give up on me, even if they don't hear from me for periods of time where sometimes I just kind of go away for a while, you know. They've been consistent through my whole life, and I'm very blessed with that. Then everything else is superfluous. But it would start with music, and then the rest would all be music. People have frequently asked me, you know, what do you do besides music? Well, I really don't. It's my hobby. It's my passion. And so, you know, my family, my friends, and then my favorite guitars, my favorite bands, you know, I don't know what life would be without that. It's been the saving grace and my solace since I was a little kid, you know, kind of a shy kid. So music has always been there for me. And now that I get to participate and produce music on the level that I aspire to and that people respond to, it's the most rewarding thing. So very thankful in that list of 10, I can't rank them all, but the people out there that, you know, support what I do and that believe in my music and just receive it with the, you know, the intent that I'm making, you know, I can't imagine, fame and money do not effing matter to me at all, but that does. And the fact that I get that so much from people that do know me and do listen to my music, that I feel like the most famous, richest person, but in the best possible way, without the burden of money and fame. Because I just think both of those things are not great. And you can look at every famous rich person and get plenty of evidence of why that's not the goal here, folks. At least that's what I've learned. That's what's important to me. So I'm on this path. I'm, you know, feeling strong and healthy. I want to just keep going, and hopefully we can be on that path together. But really, as I feel this is winding down, these are some of my favorite questions I've ever gotten. And I know I tend to ramble and answer length, but that when I'm in the right, it's like being in the studio with Kip. You guys are providing me that ability to be me. And so I appreciate that. And I thank you both for, I knew Kip wouldn't have sent me your way had he not felt that way. So kudos to Kip.
It's like we said at the top of the hour, it's Kip Met. So
it's exactly. Well, we are the Kip Winger fan club here. So yeah, everybody go to kipwinger.com and send him lots of love or wherever he's at.
But check out Andy Timmons first. Andy, this has been a very fun session. Thank you for your time. Everyone, check out Andy. That's a Texas boy now. Come and see him play live.
I get down to Richardson every now and then. I've got a dear friend that played, Jerry Don Branch, plays down at the Tavern on Main. It's just this old tavern on Main Street. The downstairs is still smoking, believe it or not, but the upstairs where we play is a non-smoking little venue. And man, if you ever can, he's like great classic Texas rock and blues. And he's a great singer, great player. The band is killing. And so I go there, you know, every few months and play on I think it's a Thursday night. They do a regular Thursday night. So it's kind of like the old Pong Kings thing. I can just go play and have fun. So come, it's in Richardson, man. You got to come hang.
We will all go together. Well,
yay!
Everyone, Andy, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you for your time, and we will catch you next time.
That sounds good. Anytime, man. Happy to hang with you guys.